Welcome to the Alamo City Investing Show. This is episode 6 with your hosts, Aaron Beal and Jason Lee. Today we have a lot of, you know, fun things to talk about. Mainly we're going to talk about sub-2 deals because those are all the rage. We're going to give some updates on some of the deals we have going on and, you know, some of the details and intricacies with that. But before we do that, just want a reminder to, you know, share this with someone who might be interested. If you can like, subscribe, share, all that stuff, super helpful to us. And we have some exciting guests kind of planned for the future, but we got to get more ears and listen to this before we can do that. So, you know, if you guys are enjoying it, we would love the feedback and, you know, appreciate you, you know, sharing this with other folks. With that being said, we're going to jump into kind of, you know, we like talking about some of the deals we've gone on. You know, sometimes those are good, sometimes those are bad. We're on this like string of like frustrating, messy deals, title issues, all that stuff. But if you're in this industry, you know it all comes in waves. So the good stuff comes in waves, the bad comes in waves. So hopefully we're kind of on the tail end of that. But yeah, we're going to jump into some of the deals we've gone on. So Jason, you want to get into that?
Sure.
Or the first one at least?
Yeah, for sure. And just to give you guys a little bit of perspective, when Aaron's saying that we're dealing with a lot of title issues right now, January, we contracted 12 properties. I think this month, we're at the end of February, we've contracted 15 to 16, but we've only closed 4 this month. So it's literally a third of the properties that are still going through title issues. And so there's a whole slew of things. I mean, when you get with off-market properties, you deal with a lot of distressed sellers that might be facing foreclosure, divorce, maybe it's an inherited property. And so inherently, off-market deals are just messy. And it's just, we kind of talk about the deals that we do just to give you guys some insight and give you some, I guess, like a heads up as far as that stuff goes. Cause it's not as easy as you sign a contract and then you go find a buyer and then boom, easy, like 10, 15K wholesale fee. So,
I mean, it can be.
It can be. But yeah. But I mean, do enough and you'll see that you're going to have to work through a lot of title issues. And that's why we always tell everyone, like, hey, go find a good investor-friendly title company. One that knows what they're doing can help you sort the stuff out so title ends up being clear. Cause I mean, we use McKnight Title, Katrina and her team. They're awesome. And honestly, we probably more than half of our deals wouldn't get to closing if we were not using someone that really knew what they were doing like them. So, but with that being said, just want to give them a little plug, but deals we have going on. So we have one right now where the seller had reached out to us. It's a property that she inherited from her parents. Both of her parents unfortunately passed away. And I think she was living with her aunt for a while, ended up getting kicked out. So she was forced to sell her parents' house because she needed the money. And like most sellers in distressed situations, she reached out and said, hey, I need to sell my house and I need it closed next week. And so we told her we're going to push it along as fast as we can, but we don't have promises.
It's fine if like, title's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually,
but it never.
Yeah, especially with an inherited property, because you're going to have to do an affidavit heirship or probate if there's a will. So that was kind of the situation she was in. And how much should we lock it up for?
48 or 50.
48, 50.
Something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
I don't remember. Yeah.
Somewhere around there. So we lock this thing up for 48, 50. We tell her, hey, we're really going to push, but there's no guarantees. So as soon as a condition of locking it up, she basically said, hey, I have no money right now. I'm staying at a hotel. I'm about to use my last dollar. Like, I really need a couple $100. And so we normally send our earnest money straight to title. But in this situation, we said, okay, let's go ahead and send. So we sent the earnest money directly to her in this case. So we gave her $500 and we thought that would be good. That could put her up in a hotel for, I don't know, a week or so. But it's kind of the classic case of you give a mouse a cookie. So we gave her the $500 and I kid you not, the next morning, she basically said, hey, I don't have any money. I ran out. I'm going to need a couple $100. Can you advance me a couple $100 from the proceeds of the sale? And so that's where it started. I quickly told our go ahead.
Yeah. And it's just, and it's not even this seller in, you know, in particular, like we don't have to get into all the details of, you know, us fronting her money for a hotel, buying her dinner, buying her whatever. But it's just kind of this category of like what I call, you know, you give a mouse a cookie, you know, based on like the kind of children's book where it's like you give the mouse a cookie, then he's gonna ask for a glass of milk, and it just keeps going and going and going, which never fails. So if you're doing off-market deals, don't be like us. Don't make the mistake of giving sellers money up front. But we've been having like everyone ask for this, which isn't super normal. But like we had one today where they're like, I have $60 and I need $28 to keep my water from being turned off on, you know, Tuesday or whatever. Can you give me $28? And we're like, no, because then it's going to be like, buy me lunch or buy this or buy that. And it just becomes that thing. So we've just been getting a lot of that lately. I don't know if there's more specifics you want to talk about.
No, not really. I mean,
it's just this general kind of like concept of like, it seems so innocent and you want to help people, but it just becomes a thing of like, okay, then it becomes this daunting task of like, oh, well now I need this or I need that or I need, you know, whatever. And it just never ends. And honestly, just makes the whole thing more emotional and stressful than it needs to be.
Using this one as an example, so we paid, gave her $500, earned us money up front, and then she asked us if we could give her more money to pay for a hotel. So we did that. Immediately after that, she's asking us to buy her food and soda, and then we give her money for that.
Close.
Go ahead.
And close.
And then what I was going to say, and then after we gave her money for food and soda, then it was, well, can you guys buy me some clothes now too? So just by even starting by...
And now she wants to, which you probably don't know this, because we haven't talked about it. Now she wants to move to the hotel across the street because she likes that one more. So that's the latest development.
Exactly. So it's just one of those things where you feel for the sellers. They might be in a tough situation, but we've seen it time and time again where if you just enable them, they're just going to keep asking and asking. So that's why we always recommend that you don't give the title company, you don't give the earnest money straight to the seller. You're going to give it straight to the title company. And as much as they beg, just say, hey, this is company policy. This is just the way it is, and cut it off right there. It's just going to save you guys a lot of headache.
Yeah. And that's one thing we've kind of learned too. Like in any of those situations, like make the policy the bad guy. Like it's not like, oh, Jason doesn't want to give you money, or like Aaron doesn't want to give you money. Like, hey, this is our company policy. Sorry, we're not able to do that. And that just kind of takes the emotion and drama out of it. But yeah, so that's something that we're, you know, the fun situation we put ourselves in the past few weeks. Another thing that, you know, kind of getting into other, you know, interesting title issue type stuff. We had a seller this week at the day of closing refused to sign because he thought he was going to get more money, which happens. But, you know, what happened in this scenario, and we've seen, I don't know, 5 or 6 times since 2020 or whenever COVID was, we have these HUD liens pop up. So I say pop up, like they signed off on, they got money for them. Like they know they exist, but everyone thinks that they don't have to pay them. So during, I don't think I ever saw them before COVID, but in the world of like forbearance and, you know, loan modifications and everything people were doing to try to keep people in their houses, there was a rise of these HUD loans or HUD liens that essentially act as like a second mortgage on a house. And in a lot of ways, they're awesome. The way they're not so awesome is sellers always claim that they don't exist, or they don't know they exist, or they completely forget about them. But they function as a second that doesn't require payments. It doesn't accrue interest, and it only has to be paid off at, you know, refi or, you know, sale of the property, which is a pretty awesome product, you know, and very helpful to people. But everyone seems to think, hey, this happened during COVID, so it's all forgiven and it doesn't exist. Or, you know, I never got this money because I just thought that the 3 years of me not paying my mortgage went away. Like I didn't think anyone was footing the bill for that. So that's kind of what that looks like. And it's been a pretty big deal killer. Not all the time, but it's definitely happened. I mean, 2 times recently, and then we've had other times before where it does or it almost does. But Jason can talk a little bit more about this specific deal and what happened, you know, with that if you want.
And these HUD loans, just to clarify, I don't know if we've really pointed this out, but the point or the intention of these HUD loans when the governments were giving it out was so that way they could use that to pay for the seller or the homeowner's mortgages. It's like, hey, I'm behind on my mortgage, So they would take out the HUD loans and it would pay for their mortgage for a year, 2 years, 3 years, however long.
Or it would catch them up when they were like $30,000 behind, or, you know, haven't made a payment in a year because it's been in forbearance and that doesn't magically go away. But something has to pay for it, right? So I think that's the use of them a lot of times.
And sellers or homeowners didn't realize that the money came from the government and the government's never just going to forgive you money. So although this money didn't hit their bank account because it went straight to the mortgage companies to pay for the mortgage, they still owe that money to the government. And so we have sellers like this one where on the day of closing, he sees this $50,000 payoff and says, what is this? I never got a $50,000 loan. So we sent him, Title sent him the paperwork where that he signed for this HUD loan. But he basically thinks he got swindled because that $50,000 never actually hit his account. It was just applied to the mortgage.
He swears it's fraud.
So he,
which is like crazy. But.
So he says he can't sell anymore. He wants more from the proceeds. And I think he fails to realize that no matter what direction he goes, he's going to pay back that $50,000 if he's going to sell the home. Otherwise, he's just going to keep it forever, I guess.
That's some of the fun stuff we're kind of dealing with right now. You know, we're having probably our busiest month ever. So that's a positive. And hopefully, some stuff will start moving pretty smooth. One thing I meant to mention earlier, which I don't know if I did or not, is if you guys are looking for deals, hit us up. We are wholesaling more than we ever have. Today alone, we sent out 3 new deals. Stuff's been moving quick. So if you're looking for projects or rentals or whatever in San Antonio, we'd love to sell you some deals. That being said, we're going to jump into kind of our main topic today, which is the glorious world of sub-2 deals. So these have definitely, you know, been gaining in popularity. They've been around forever, but, you know, they're definitely, you know, a hot topic right now for a number of reasons. But before we jump into some of that, like, what is a sub-2 loan? What do people like? What does that mean? You know, what's a sub-2 deal? Like, what is it? What is it, Jason?
And sub-2, that stands for subject to. And basically what that is that you as the buyer would be taking over payments, mortgage payments for the seller. So this is often confused with, I guess, I'm blanking on the term.
Assumption or assignment.
Yeah, an assumption of the loan where the loan, the seller's mortgage is transferred to your name. In this case, the mortgage stays in the seller's name. You're just taking over the payments for it. So
deed transfers, financing stays. Mm-hmm.
So the deed and the title will transfer ownership and the mortgage will stay in their name. And so the reason why this is so popular right now is because, as we all know, interest rates have gone up quite a bit. So a lot of people were burning before in order to collect rental properties. But that worked when you had a 2%, 3%, 4%. When you're looking at a 7%, 8%, 9%, 10%, even 10%, that doesn't cash flow or work anymore. So this is something that we initially weren't trying to target and we still aren't necessarily targeting, but we're seeing more and more opportunities rise with this because we're having a lot of sellers right now that bought at the peak of the market, maybe from 2020 to maybe 2022. So they don't have a lot of equity. The market's gone down. So they don't have enough equity to sell, but they have this interest rate of 3%, 4%, which is basically impossible to get now. So did I miss anything there as far as explaining what sub-2 is and why it's so popular?
I don't think so. I mean, it's been around for a while. I think it's often sold as this like no money game, which we can talk about, but it's rarely actually the case. Yeah. I mean, we're very much like the we buy your house cash people, but we've started doing more of these and we've, you know, collected a handful of them and we probably do more than most the people that talk about sub-2 as their main strategy. But that being said, I mean, I would take a buying a house cash over buying sub-2 pretty much every day, but it gives us the opportunity in certain situations, you know, to still buy people's houses. It still makes sense. And, you know, a lot of times it is honestly their best option, right? If they don't have enough equity or, you know, haven't been in the house very long. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and yeah, why it's gaining in popularity now, I mean, it's been popular for a while, but you know, like you said, a lot of stuff that we're buying sub two now is, you know, 2-4% interest when, like, with the best credit in the world, best down payment, whatever, you know, best qualifications for a loan, you're getting like 6-7%, right? So it's, I would say for us, the one way we found we can buy stuff to keep as rentals that will cash flow or almost cash flow, or, you know, be close enough that it's worth, you know, holding on to and messing with. And we can, you know, jump into some of the, you know, situations where we've done that. You know, we bought, you know, a multi-million dollar house sub two, and, you know, that allowed us to have a lot cheaper payments. It wasn't a long-term thing, but it made sense for us and the seller. So we did it. But yeah, so kind of why is it popular now? I think Jason, you know, touched on that a little bit, but like we're seeing prices are just super stagnant, at least in San Antonio. You know, we're probably similar to the, you know, highs you saw in 21 and 22. We haven't dropped off a ton, but, you know, things haven't really continued to, you know, raise in value. So, you know, a lot of times if people haven't owned their house for more than 3, 4, or 5 years and want to sell, they might not have enough equity to sell it, you know, either to a cash buyer or just listing on the market or the traditional method. So that's where this is, you know, coming into effect now. But we're seeing a lot of stuff that, like, we could buy sub two, but there's no way to make it make sense. You know, the rental rates don't work. The, you know, 6.5%, 7% interest on this stuff that someone's owned a year and they don't have equity. Like, it just doesn't make sense, even, you know, buying stuff sub two a lot of times. So that's, you know, kind of what we're seeing in today's market. But yeah, what I missed there, Jason?
No, I kind of want to skip ahead. You brought up a good point of not everything makes sense and is a good deal just because it's sub two. I feel like there's this stigma around sub two where if it's sub two, it must be a good deal. If it's a low interest rate, it must be a good deal. So we are a part of a lot of Facebook groups where people are pushing out sub two deals. They're trying to wholesale it, or they're trying to ask for advice on how to make it work. And it's like a great example. I saw one the other day where it's this like $600,000 house. The house is probably worth 600. They're taking over a loan for, you know, 595. There's not really much equity there. And it's like a 4% interest rate, and it's 1000% going to negative cash flow. And they're asking, hey, how can I make this work? The seller wants 20K to walk away with. You know, does this make sense? I'm getting a 4% interest rate, but I have to put down 20K. And I feel like a lot of people would look at that and say, oh yeah, it's a great deal. You're getting a house at 4%. But if you look at how we look at it, one, there's not much equity there. Two, if you're coming to closing with 20K down, you know, that's technically negative equity at that point, because you have to pay 20K. And then three, it's not cash flowing whatsoever. So if your plan is to live it as a primary, maybe that's one thing. But if your plan is to keep it as a rental property, you're losing money pretty much every single month. So with that being said, what does a good sub two deal look like, Aaron? Or what do we kind of look for when we decide to take something on as a sub two?
Yeah, great question. So a lot of the criteria people have is just not good. It's either like, can I get into it with no money? Like that alone doesn't make it a good deal. We're the kind of people that we want to get into it with no money, and we want to have equity, and we want a good interest rate. I would say for us, it's like we need at least two of those three. You know, we've done some lately that don't have a ton of equity, maybe 20 grand or something, like enough that they can't sell it on the market, but not something super exciting. But if we're taking on something that doesn't have much equity, we're making sure we have a good interest rate, you know, it cash flows. And a lot of times it's something that we're not either, you know, we're not going to have to put in a bunch of money to get it rentable, livable, whatever. So that's kind of the only scenario we will do the low equity type stuff. You know, if like we've done some of those lately where it's like, hey, you know, the foundation's off an inch. You can't feel it in the house, but a retail buyer wouldn't buy it. And you have, you know, $30,000 in equity, but it's a 4-year-old house and it rents, and, you know, it you know, will cash flow or at least break even and provide us the tax benefits of owning the rental, and it's going to appreciate. So we'll do it. But a lot of these, you know, we're the people that are offering, you know, sub two when we want to buy a 70 or 75% deal, and maybe it's an 80 or 85% deal. So would I do it with, you know, 15% equity? Absolutely. You know, because a lot of these, you know, people don't tell you that, like, they all cost money. Like, so on some occasions we are, if there's enough equity in it, we're, you know, sometimes giving them some cash, you know, $5,000-$10,000. We are getting a title policy. We are paying attorneys or a title company to close it, depending on, you know, who we use. And then at a minimum, we're paying to clean it out. But most of these, we're going in and we're doing some minor stuff like, you know, floors, paint, you know, a few thousand dollars. So even best case scenario, a lot of times we're out $5,000 to $15,000. I mean, granted, we have, you know, a good asset. Almost all of the ones we've done are, they're all pretty new houses. I don't think we have anything older. If we do, they're like recently remodeled. So they're good assets with good rates that, you know, rent, maybe cash flow a little bit, maybe break even. But, you know, so for us, it's like, we're not the, you know, low equity, negative equity people. You know, we still want them to make sense. It's kind of how we look at those, or what we think is a, you know, good deal. And maybe you can get into like our approach to them and, you know, what are your exit strategies? Do we sell them? Do we wrap them? Do we, you know, what do we do with them? You know, because I think that's a place we're probably different than most people.
Sure. And before I get into that, I just wanted to touch on what you said about it being turnkey. We don't, if we plan to keep it as a rental, we don't want something we have to dump a bunch of money and fix up. So I think all the ones we've kept as rentals for sub two, I think the oldest house is like a 2017 or 2018 build. So these are houses that don't really need much work. I think we spent maybe $5,000 at most doing some touch-up paint, replacing carpet. That's pretty much it. So I wanted to do that, but I guess I wanted to point that out. But as far as exit strategy goes, for us, our main exit strategy is keep it as a rental and keep it for a very long time. I don't know if we're going to keep it in 50 years from now, but we're going to be keeping it for a long time, where we can build that equity in there, we maintain that low interest rate. And then later on, if we like to sell a property or what have you, that's fine too. But we know that because it's at least breaking even, we can kind of let it sit there and build equity and appreciation. And so that's what we mainly do. We have done a couple sub twos as flips where it, you know, these are fairly clean properties, or maybe they just need a little bit of work, but we take it sub two instead of getting a hard money loan. And so that saves us on some higher interest, some points, and we're able to maybe pay a little bit more money, you know, if we need to pay them, you know, an extra couple thousand out of pocket just to kind of get that lower interest rate.
And a lot of times that conversation is, you know, us talking to the seller like, hey, you know, if you're willing to hold this for 6 months and be the bank, we can probably pay you $5,000 more, $10,000 more. Like, essentially, we're going to be paying these costs to a lender one way or another. That can be you or that can be someone else. And a lot of times, you know, that can be a situation where you're able to flip or wholesale the house with little to no money out of pocket, you know, paying that 3 to 7% interest rate instead of 8 to 12%. You know, plus points, you'd pay hard money. And a lot of times it's kind of a win-win for everyone.
And when we go that direction too, what we especially like is when we tell the seller like, hey, we'll take it sub two right now, you become the bank, and we'll pay you a little bit extra on the back end. So it's not even like, hey, on the front end, when we close on the property, we'll give you that 5,000. We tell them, hey, we'll give you the extra 5,000 at the end once we sell it. So we don't have to come out of pocket with any money. So that's a little tip for some of the listeners.
Yeah. So to give a real life example of that, so this house we bought in Bernie, we paid $2.1 million for it. And the seller actually approached us and told us he was open to sub two. Good guy, business owner, pretty like savvy, you know, business owner. And he's like, hey, I've kind of heard about this. Like, I'm open to this if, you know, you want to buy it that way. So he owed like 1.6 on it. We were buying it for 2.1. We essentially gave him, what was it, 400-ish K cash. And then we're going to give them another 100 when we sell. So balloon the last 100 on the end. And we have a 3.75% rate on 1.6 million instead of, you know, 12%, right? So on something where on, if you took, you know, hard money, your holding costs would be, you know, $30,000 a month. Now our holding costs are like, what are they? 12, 13, 14, something like that.
Jason? It's about 13 with the taxes and insurance all escrowed. And the other neat thing too, is that in situations like the one you just described, that deal that we're doing right now, is that because we are paying the mortgage every single month, you're paying down you're building equity in the property. And you're paying down that principal.
So it's not interest only like a traditional private or hard money payment would be. And of course, with that, you know, you got to make sure, you know, you cross all your T's, dot your I's to make sure that the paperwork and everything reflects that. And that was one thing that we made sure we did, because I'm like, hey, I want to make sure we're getting the pay down. Like, he's getting 100 at close. We get everything in between if we pay it down for 3, 4, 5, 6 months. So another benefit of that.
Absolutely. And it's just nice. I mean, 15,000 or 14,000 holding costs every month is a lot, but much better than the 25 to 30K we would have been paying if we had taken hard money on that one. And fingers crossed, but it looks like we have an offer coming in the next couple of days. So once that deal finishes, we'll probably bring it up on the podcast, because that'll be a cool one to maybe dive into.
Yeah, for sure. It'll be a fun one once we don't own it.
Absolutely. So we've been like, we talked about what we look for in a deal, the strategy with it. We see a lot of people that are doing it, I would say, just completely wrong. And there's a lot of risks and a lot of consequences with sub two if it's not done correctly. And I wanted to kind of touch on that. But Aaron, do you want to talk about some of the risks with sub two? Because a lot of people, again, like you said, make it seem like, oh, it's this great way to build rental properties without having any money into it.
A few things. So I think a lot of people try to be overly like creative with it, where honestly, we don't force, like we try to not in general, not to force deals. So, you know, I'll see these deals that it's like, oh, like the house is worth 200. You're going to take it sub two at 150. And then you're going to give the seller 10 grand and then you're going to pay my assignment fee. And then there's going to be another 20 grand you pay over 5 years. And then another 20 grand you balloon at closing. And just try to make things like overly complex, which my thing is like, that to me is like, you just need to negotiate better. Don't do their second loans, or, you know, we've offered that sometimes, but it's more of a thing of like, hey, if you can't get a better deal than that, like you just need to get better at negotiating, you know, have a better offer. But the other thing that I think we see a lot is that we're pretty much like, well, so, I mean, exit strategies, right? So we've told you we pretty much have two exit strategies. We hold it as a rental because we trust ourselves to control it and to take care of the seller. We occasionally will sell them we sold them to a project manager who it's his primary residence. If he doesn't pay it, we know where to find him and track him down and, you know, make sure that seller's taken care of. We would probably wholesale them to people we know and trust. Other than that, I think it's super problematic when, you know, people are wholesaling these deals, and it's one thing to buy it and, you know, hold yourself to a standard of I'm going to take care of the seller. It's a whole other thing to, hey, I've never met Jason before, but he gave me $10,000. So now I'm going to put this entire thing in his hands, right? With no qualifications, you know, I don't know if Jason's a piece of shit or not, sort of thing. So we just completely refuse to wholesale them, and we lose out or miss out on a ton of deals because we won't do this. But from a moral and ethical standpoint, I can't make it like, we're both like, no, we're not doing this. Like, it's not worth the quick bucks or whatever. So that's one thing that we won't do. A lot of people sell these on wraps. Honestly, I think that's a little safer than wholesaling them, just because you're still kind of in the middle and involved, but that can get messy. And when I say a wrap, it's essentially you are, you know, creating a mortgage on top of the mortgage. So I buy the house for 100. I sell it to Jason I keep that mortgage in place, create a new mortgage to Jason for 150. I make the difference in the equity and also the difference in the two interest rates. So that's what we mean when we say selling it on a wrap. People do that. a few years ago, like these negative equity wraps were a big thing, which I think it's one of those things you can do one here and there, but like, do I want 100 of those if the shit hits the fan? Absolutely not. So we've actually never sold one on a wrap. We potentially would, but I don't think we're going to make a business model of it. But yeah, and then we've personally bought two like failed wraps, failed sub two deals that like completely screwed the sellers over. You know, one, you know, about years ago, they bought it and then put a renter in, collected the rent, never paid the mortgage, and then fought the seller and sued them once they tried to take it back. It dragged on for years, almost went to foreclosure. Just a whole nightmare of a situation. And we bought one recently that was kind of a, you know, the same thing, right? So there's definitely, you know, ways to do these wrong. But I think, you know, I guess our perspective on it is if you're doing these, you need to be in a position that if the shit hits the fan, you can deal with it. If they call the loan due, deal with it. You know, like if you need to sell the house, deal, you know, like we just, you know, think it's the right thing to do to the seller. If you're going to be buying these sub two, that if something happens, you're taking care of it. But yeah, so Jason, you want to jump into some of, you know, the more of the risk of that, like some of the obvious stuff or, you know, lesser known stuff or, you know, what should people be aware of before they jump into this?
Absolutely. And remember the biggest thing, guys, and the reason why Aaron and I are both so cautious when it comes to people wholesaling the stuff or doing wraps is because, again, the mortgage stays in the seller's name. That means this debt is still in their name, and at the end of the day, they're still responsible for it. So if you decide not to make the interest payments to basically, it's going to wreck their credit. Like, it's going to wreck their credit. It could be, you know, foreclosed on by the bank and everything like that. And this is like probably the biggest loan that most people will have in their entire lives. So it's a big responsibility. And that's what we want to remind people constantly, is that someone's livelihood and their credit and their finances are kind of in your hands. So that's something that's not to be taken lightly. But one of the biggest risks with sub two that is probably the most well-known risk is the due on sale clause. The due on sale clause is something that lenders will put into their loan documents and everything that basically says that if title or ownership transfers on a property from, you know, from one person to another, one entity to another, whatever, then they can call the loan due. So this has always been a risk and most people have ignored it, but I feel like fairly recently there's been more due on sale clauses being called. And I don't know. Have you been seeing that, Aaron? Or is that just, what are your thoughts on that?
Everyone you talk to says something different. Mm-hmm. In some groups I've seen people saying that. I don't know. I mean, I've talked to other, you know, talked to one of the attorneys here locally that we've done some sub two deals with. And she's like, no, I haven't seen her, you know, increase in that. I think it just depends. You know, there's the risk for it happening, but I don't know that. It has increased. A lot of people think it will, you know, just kind of with the theory of, hey, the bank can lend money out at 7%. Like, why would they be okay with it being out at 3% or 2% or 4%? I guess I kind of err on the side of like, do the banks like watch stuff that closely? And is it worth the whole foreclosing on it? You know, all of that to do that. I don't know. But I don't know the process. I don't know if they have people looking at this stuff. And then there's the whole, you know, if there's not that much equity, are they really going to try to foreclose on something that maybe they foreclose and they're upside down on? I mean, logic would tell me no, but who knows? So I guess, like, long story short, I don't know if it's increasing. I don't know if it's happening more. It's, you know, a known risk with any time you're buying something sub two.
Got it. Yeah, I kind of see both sides of that. And so when it is called due, usually people have 30 days, 60 days to pay back that loan. And that's a big reason why we say that we don't like to buy stuff with negative equity, right? Like if you're in that situation and you had to go and refinance the property to pay that lender back, or you have to go and sell the property, at least you have the equity to play around with. Because the last thing you want is to have something with negative equity. You have zero options. And then, you know, you kind of screw the seller by either defaulting or you deed it back to them. And then they're stuck with this property that they didn't want to deal with, which is why they sold in the first place. So that is, that's probably one of the biggest risks. So maybe that leads us into like how we set up Sub 2. This is how we do it. Are we experts in Sub 2? Not by any means. We've just talked to people that know more than us, and we're constantly trying to evolve and change and do it better. But the way we set everything up was pretty much, and this has changed over the past couple that we've done, but when we buy it, we basically buy it in a trust. And so, you know, we put the, instead of, you know, Murphy Home Buyers or whatever, our company, we'll put it into a trust. And then that way we keep the seller as a beneficiary. And the pro to that is if they want to go, and let's say they want to go buy another house later on down the line, we can basically show them as part of the trust and therefore part owner of the company. And then if we rent out the property and everything, they can use those rents to offset the debt, because again, the mortgage is still in their name. So that's pretty much how we buy it. And then we also at closing have a ton of forms that we use and a ton of disclosures, because I think another big risk is if the sellers don't know what they're actually signing or really don't know the process, that can get you in a lot of hot water. So we make sure that all of our documents are very clear as to what we are doing. So the mortgage is still going to be in your name. We're going to make making payments on your behalf. If we are late on payments, then we would basically default deed it back to them, so they don't have to, you know, foreclose on us or whatever. So that's a big thing, is making sure that the sellers know what the process is and educating them.
Yeah. And with that, I would just add, like, always err on the side of, like, you know, disclosing everything, you know, being overly thorough with that. So anytime we're doing anything creative, like, I think you have, there's this tendency of like, oh, if they see everything, they'll be like, they won't want to do it. But honestly, for us, whether it's this or any other sort of like creative finance deal, we found like, just like throw it all out there, right? Like, be completely open. Like, hey, we need your social security number. Hey, we need X, Y, and Z. We need your logins to your account. We need all this authorization. Oh, we need a limited power of attorney to get information, you know, all of this stuff, right? So we've found that like, the more you disclose, the earlier you put all that out there. So a lot of times we'll send all this stuff on the front end with the contract before they even look at that, just so they know exactly what they're getting into. Because our goal is on closing day, there'd be no surprises. And I remember the first one we did, and I was sitting, or first, second, whatever. I was sitting through closing, which we don't normally do closing at the same time. And I just remember like the closing attorney reading through everything. And I'm like, I was just so nervous. I'm like, because it was just, everything's completely out there, like, you know, completely disclosed. But the seller was good with it. They knew what they were getting into. They knew for this situation, this was a good solution. But, you know, I think there's a tendency to, like, try to just get it signed, get it done. Maybe don't talk about it. Like, you know, it's not an issue if you just don't bring it up. But I would just caution you to, like, don't do that. Like, disclose everything. Be super open about everything. It's going to serve you better in the future with the whole situation.
Yeah, I can already see, and I'm sure this has already happened, people getting sued for not disclosing the stuff properly and the seller not know what's going on, or maybe that the buyer misses a payment and it hurts their credit and then it unravels this whole thing. I could totally see that being something that pops up more as Sub 2 becomes more popular. So, you know, we're just trying to educate people on like what Sub 2 is, and just the risks and how to do it properly. And there's tons of ways to do it properly, but we do see people out there and gurus out there just teaching it completely wrong and setting a lot of not only the buyers, but especially the sellers up for failure. And that's going to be a big issue in the future.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's, I mean, you know, like anything, it's, you know, don't try to force it to being a deal. Like, I see, you know, a lot of these groups, it's like, oh, it doesn't work as a short-term rental or a long-term rental. But if like you and your 23 best friends all, you know, get in here and add bunk beds and, you know, rent it by the bed, it suddenly makes sense. I would just say, don't try to force these. If it makes sense, it makes sense. If not, you know, maybe they need to sell it on the market. Maybe they need to wait it out. Like, you know, it's not necessarily your job to get them out of the situation, but, you know, in certain situations, it's a really good solution.
Yeah. And I am starting to see people post sub two on other things besides houses, like vehicles, or I don't even know, just like the randomest things. They're like, oh, does anyone want to take over this thing sub two? So I think that's kind of funny that people are now starting to apply it to cars and, I mean, who knows what, like maybe timeshare memberships, who knows?
Yeah, things without, you can't like easily collateralize, which is silly, but.
Anyways, is that everything we have for today's episode, Aaron?
Yeah, I think so. And I guess, you know, like always, if you have questions about this stuff, reach out. We're glad to, you know, help you guys walk through these deals, you know, help you look at it, see if they make sense. You know, we're not experts on this. Like we've done enough that we know a little bit of what we're talking about, but like, I'm not your sub two guru. You know, we can talk through these a little bit, but you know, if you're looking at something like this and you have questions or you don't know how to structure it, anything like that, we're glad to, you know, look at it and, you know, help however we can. But yeah, I think that's all we have for this week. If you want to reach out to me or Jason, the best place is probably Instagram. Mine is just aaron.beal. Jason is investor Jason Lee. And yeah, we, you know, love responding to people there, love interacting with people there. And of course, you know, if you can share this with people, give us feedback, all that stuff is super helpful. And yeah, that's all we got. And we will see y'all next week.
Bye, guys.